sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
GDP revised upward. Earnings season at the halfway point. IMF's Gold China. And our guest today, Eric Fish, author of the new book, China's Millennials. All this and much more on episode number 423 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to August. This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And we have a good amount to talk about, a good guest to talk with as well today. So I'm pretty excited about that. We have a pretty good lineup coming up. As a matter of fact, we're booked solid for the next several weeks and episodes. We have coming up Jim Rogers next week, author, world traveler, investor. You know him. He's wrote the book, A Bull in China. We have Ellen Loyan. She's an author, a speaker, branding expert, works for Branded for Life, and there's a lot of things we're going to go through there in terms of what is going on with advertising, etc. Declan Falcon, blogger, market commentary from activistclients.com and Signals. Interesting person to talk to about some of the interesting things that are going on with regard to technology and investing. Cullen Roche from The Pragmatic Capitalist. We have Russ Roberts and Tadas Viskanis coming up in September, at the end of September, from Abnormal Returns. And we have probably a few more in there as well. Now, I was on I was the guest of Frank Curzio on his podcast this week. And I got to tell you, we talked about a lot of things. We talked about China to a great degree. Talked about my trip, but also talked about the investing opportunities or the pitfalls when it comes to China. And I'd really encourage you to take a listen to that particular podcast. You can find that over at frankcurzio.com. You could also go to iTunes, and you can get and download the or subscribe to Frank Curzio's Wall Street Unplugged podcast. I encourage you to listen to that particular podcast, if not all the others from Frank as well. Good stuff there. And of course, each and every week, you can also hear me on DH Unplugged, which is a podcast I do with John C. Dvorak. And that's kind of a twist to what's going on in the business world and the news that happens on a regular basis that you'll find pretty entertaining and amusing. Whereas this podcast is, we have a lot of great information and guests and insight, stock ideas, things of that nature, helping you with investing, education. That is much more of, I would say, business entertainment. So you got to check that out. DH Unplugged, dhunplugged.com. You can see as well. All right. What else have I got going on? Let's talk about, let's start off with some of the weekly economics that went on. You know, it was the last week of the month, and oftentimes we see a good amount of window dressing. Now, if you don't know what window dressing is, essentially what it is at the end of the month, end of the quarter, end of the year, mutual funds, hedge fund managers, they get their portfolio set so that two things. Number one, it can have the structure and look of what they're looking for to make sure that when they produce their reports, that it will be set up correctly. Because in between that, you know, maybe they have different holdings and maybe they're trying to build on a particular position or get rid of a position. For example, let's say that they own a stock that just has done absolutely awful, but they don't want to really show that for some reason, even though it's in the performance, but they don't want to show this particular stock. They can actually sell it out before the end of the quarter, maybe even buy it back afterwards if they want to still hold on to it for some reason, but therefore it doesn't really show up at the end of the period for when they are having to prepare their various statements and then send it out to their clientele. In addition, what happens is during window dressing time, usually the last week of the month of the quarter, the Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, those dates. Usually what you'll find is that there is a chase to bring up markets, particularly if markets have fallen off or individual stocks or sectors have fallen off during the quarter or during the period. Because obviously the way that hedge funds and many mutual funds or many different institutional managers bill is at the end of the period. So they want to make sure that their portfolios are looking good. They want to make sure there's nothing in there that can get them in trouble with their shareholders and their investors. And they also want to make sure that they can squeeze out as much profitability that they can in terms of fees. Well, that makes sense. So window dressing is this kind of process that goes on that we all know about. We've all kind of know what's going on. The big question about window dressing is what happens post-window dressing? You know, what happens after we see the maybe 2 or 3 days that there is a reversal in markets? And do we continue with the trend either down or up, depending on where it was and what happens? Right now, we are looking at a trend that is suspect at best. We are seeing clearly a consolidation pattern. If you haven't looked at the S&P or the Dow, the NASDAQ, there is a pretty good consolidation that has been going on through 2015, whereas a consolidation is you have a range. Right now, the range is about approximately 2040 on the S&P 500 to about 2130. Pretty big range. You could probably narrow that up and tighten it up just a little bit if you wanted to really get down to brass tacks of where the actual range is. But what we're seeing is this range that when we get to the top of the range, there's a sell-off. We get to the bottom of the range, what happens is buyers step in. And why is that? Why do we see a consolidation? What is the whole point of a consolidation? Technically, when you look at a consolidation and you do identify that, what you could probably say the first thing you should think about is that there is price agreement. That within this general range, there is some price agreement that, you know, the price of the market, the price of a stock is probably appropriate at these levels. And when it's appropriate at these levels, that means that, you know, there won't be a lot of buying, a lot of selling, but when it gets over the level or under the level, there will be action taken. Now, when you have no price agreement is where you see the movement that happens very quickly and breaks out. Because all of a sudden, you have a situation where there's a lot of sellers that say, well, you know what, I'll be in this until it gets to a certain point, and I'll be selling and shorting the stock up to a certain point. And the buyers then say, no, this is worth a lot more. And they push the stock a lot higher. That brings the sellers and the short sellers to cover their positions. And once they cover those positions, what you get is a major short squeeze. And so you see this kind of situation where there's a lack of either agreement or there is some other news that comes in. And right now we're seeing the twofold issues. We're seeing that news has been wide and varied. We're seeing that in Greece, we saw all that, you know, the headlines and all that this is going on. There was some bailout. Again, there's maybe not a bailout going on, or at least there's no agreement by Greece. They did get the short-term loans to pay off the EU, or from the EU to pay off the ECB, I should say. And now there's some bickering going on in the back rooms again of Greece about what they're going to do. And then we have China. China's been a big issue. We see that the stock market is off 40% from their high on July 12th in the Shanghai Shenzhen Index. And that's a big problem, and that's drawing on the world to say what's going on there. We saw this week that China came out with two sets of information. The first was the quote-unquote non-official manufacturing gauge, which slipped significantly. But the manufacturing gauge that came out over the weekend, this weekend, saw that there was a drop in their manufacturing down to 50. Now, 50 is that demarcation line that talks about, well, under 50 is contraction. Over 50 is expansion. So it's right on 50. So I'm not sure what that means. It's kind of neutral. Nothing's going on. But the trend has clearly been slowing in China. And it was seeing that really significantly across all sectors. We're also seeing that many of their economic gauges are slowing down. We saw the GDP is at 7%, so they say. Exports, retail sales slowing down, etc. And the big problem right now is that that is showing up in commodity prices. Because as China is slowing, one of the world's super economies, they are having a lot less need for many commodities. So you're seeing that copper and iron and palladium and silver, all the various metals that go into producing various products, gold put on the side for a second. You're seeing that oil is also slipping because there's a concern that there's a slowdown. And all this is very deflationary. At the same time, let's talk about some economics that are going on. Consumer confidence is dipping. We saw that July brought in a about a 9-point dip in consumer confidence, according to the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index. It fell to about 90.9. Now, the University of Michigan's consumer index that came out held up better. It lost about 3 points in July, moving down to a mark of about 93.1. So a lot of the news, a lot of the turmoil in markets around the world is obviously starting to sink in a little bit with consumers and with investors saying, hey, there's something out there that's troubling me. So that's that component of why there is this consolidation. And on top of that, there's some concern about earnings. Pending home sales slipped, but the price index for homes actually moved up slightly. The National Association of Retailers announced about a 1.8% fall for pending home sales. Not a big deal. No, nothing really significant there. But analysts polled by MarketWatch saw about a 0.6 gain. The Case-Shiller Home Price Index, which comes out, and it looks at the various pricing of homes on a month over and a year over year basis, and it looks at the 20 city, which we look at, showed an overall 4.4% gain on a year-over-year basis, which was up slightly from April. I guess that was, I think that was 4.3% in April. Now, the big news of the week clearly was GDP, because there was a big hoo-ha about the first quarter's GDP and how it's not really right, and there's some factors in seasonality that goes into it that usually causes over the last, 20 or so quarters on a first quarter basis, so 20 years, that first quarter is very weak and somehow it pops back up the second quarter. So after all this hubbubloo and argument and concern, finally, it seems that the Bureau of Economic Analysis decided to change their methodology for how they calculate GDP, and in particular for the first quarter. Now, if you recall, the first quarter was a negative 0.2, I think it was, or so, last read. So the official reading of GDP last quarter, before they changed the methodology, was a negative. Okay? So now what happened is that we saw that it popped to a positive. So we saw that there was a positive GDP in the first quarter, which is good, but the second quarter was less. And if you calculate all of the GDPs over the last, I think they did this for 2 or 3 years, where they recalibrated their calculation and changed their methodology. Actually, if you calculate all of the GDP now together and you look at what it was, it fell down compared to what the original total readings were. So this whole analysis, even though it did help the first quarter of this year, the overall GDP going backwards showed less growth overall for the U.S. economy over the last 2 years. I don't think that was their intention. I think that all the people who were looking to revise this number were thinking that by revising the first quarter, it would smooth things out and actually come up with a better overall number. But you have to be somewhat fair, I guess, in all this. And the bigger news, I guess, was that the Federal Reserve left interest rates just totally alone last week. As a matter of fact, their statement was kind of void of any real direction. And more so, they didn't have their traditional Q&A session after their release of the data. The big concern came the next day when we saw that wage growth had actually been extremely disappointing. And the problem was that there's very little wage growth right now, and that falls very short of expectations for inflation. When you have wage growth, which is on the heels of employment growth like we've seen lately, you should expect to see some kind of wage pressure to the upside and therefore consumer discretionary spending going higher. And what happens from there is you get inflation, right? Does that make sense? So you see that there's more people working. You see that there is a good amount of potential for more money to be filling the pockets of consumers because more people have payrolls and making money. And from there, you also see that as more people are being put on, the potential for wage growth, and then you get this inflationary condition. Interestingly, the wage growth has been declining since the 80s on a regular basis. I mean, it's pretty much a good slope lower of wage growth. And we looked at this very carefully to try to understand what is going on here and how is that going to affect things. One of the big things it affects is that the potential for the Fed to raise interest rates, which is just all over the news. Anytime you turn on a television and a financial or a business show, or you read something, somewhere embedded in a page on the front page is going to be something about the Fed, because everything is about the Fed. So now what we have is a situation where there's a real concern about how is the Fed going to raise rates when there's no wage increase and when inflation is tepid at best, GDP has slowed down a bit. The only thing that really has a real bright spot to it is the employment. And employment is obviously important, but how is employment doing so well in the face of a slowing economic circumstance domestically and more so around the globe? And on top of it, we have all this deflationary pressures from commodities recently, and that's where all things get pretty tricky. Markets, on the other hand, really like the idea that there's no wage growth, because what that means is that companies have the opportunity to bring people on but not pay them anymore, and so they're not seeing a lot of degradation to their net earnings from wage growth issues, but more so markets like it because they see that the Fed could possibly postpone a rate increase until 2016 or beyond. Who knows? But the one thing about wage growth that I want to talk to you about is a big question mark. And the question mark that I have is, you know, and I wonder about this is, why is there no wage growth? So there's probably two things that we can point to. I think this is a very important item that we really need to focus on because it is a bit of a change in the economic circumstance when it comes to what is normal, quote unquote. And maybe because we're not in a normal condition where we have interest rates at zero, where we have a global economic circumstance that it was being pushed and pulled by central banks, maybe that's something to do with it. But part of it is also technology and automation enhancements. We're seeing that productivity is keeping up and companies are able to deliver on their, whether it's services or whether it's their manufacturing or, you know, sales. Even though sales are a little bit short in terms of the S&P, we are halfway through the earnings season and about 73% of stocks have beat their lowered earnings estimates by analysts. And we are seeing about a 50% increase or 50% beat rate by revenues, which is a little bit light. But the whole point here is that when you have a situation where automation is coming in so significantly and you have technology that is taking the place of many of the tasks that humans would do, the fact is that while you put more people on, you do it at less of an overall cost, because when you multiply the fact that you're paying them a lower wage and there is no wage growth, that turns out to be beneficial for some companies. Now, what else could be why we're finding wage pressures or lack of wage pressure, really just a nothingness in terms of growth? Probably we could mention that offshoring, pushing many jobs that we had previously here in the United States onto China, Vietnam, Philippines, and all countries around the world and Latin America at a lower cost is providing the opportunity for many companies to say, hey, wait a minute, if we're going to increase your wage for this job done, why don't we see if there's an alternative place where we could do so, maybe not pay benefits, maybe not have a requirement for unions or whatever else is going on here in the United States, and maybe move the money that we're paying for that service somewhere else, and therefore keeping wages down because people are realizing that, hey, wait a minute, I can't really push for a raise because if I do, there may be somebody else that would take my position right now, and I'm pretty happy having a job. And it could be just simply a hangover effect from all the jobs lost back in 2007 through 2009, where many people are just happy to have their jobs, not pressing for more income and saying, hey, you know what? We're going to hold off on any major push for any kind of wage increase. And companies are saying, hey, we realize that this is going on and you know, we can take advantage of this. There are probably a lot of other reasons, but I will tell you that the real fact here is that we are living in unusual times with an unusual circumstance, whereas the markets are not able to run on their own because we have the constant drip of the stimulus factor coming from countries all around the world. Russia just cut their interest rate from 11.5 to 11 just this week, and who knows who's next. And we see that China is buying stocks in their own market, which we'll talk about at the end of the show. I have some comments about that after we talk with our guest.
You're seeing that obviously Europe is pumping money in through quantitative easing. We're seeing that all over the world there is central bank activity that is continually working on stimulating, propping up, or massaging markets any way possible. Maybe that condition, just the inadvertent overflow from that, is the fact that somehow economies are unable to grow significantly because money is being placed to the wrong places, whereas companies are, instead of doing capital expenditures, are utilizing share buyback programs and increasing monies back to their shareholders in the form of dividends. Maybe that is stymieing growth. Maybe there is this international and globalization situation that's going on, and maybe it's technology. So all those things together, I think, bring into a real clear picture of how it's going to be very difficult to have wage growth unless we see a very significant increase in economic activity in the U.S., and that itself will be very difficult if the rest of the world is stuck in neutral as they are right now, or even kind of falling backwards. We'll talk some more about China. We'll talk about the Fed and what they did. We'll talk about some other things right after we talk with our guests. So let's get right down to it. Our guest today is Eric Fish, author of China's Millennials, The Want Generation. And Eric has done a lot of interviews with scholars and journalists and hundreds of young Chinese folks that has him providing information on the generation that is a bit different from others. So we're going to get into this conversation. I think it's going to be pretty interesting. Eric, how are you?
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations on your book. I know it came out in the beginning of June, and you spent a lot of time doing a lot of research. So let's talk a little bit about the basic concept of, you know, what you were trying to get at here. So what was it that you first thought was, okay, you know what, there's some interesting ideas here about, you know, the millennials and this generation in China. What was it that stuck out that made you say, hey, this is book worthy?
I think there's been a lot of coverage of the young generation in China that's come of age after China's economy really boomed in the 90s and the 2000s. And I think a lot of the focus is, there's like the stereotype of the little emperors, the kids that have been raised only children and amid a pretty torrid economic growth, so they've had it pretty well compared to earlier generations. But there's a lot of socioeconomic issues unfolding right now in China that are making things pretty difficult for the young generation. And one of the other stereotypes is that since Tiananmen in 1989, there's been a really nationalistic emphasis in China's education system and media that's maybe subdued young people away from raising their voices. And again, I think that's a stereotype that's becoming less and less relevant as well as this generation becomes a bit more confident and has more grievances to air. I think they're starting to raise their voices up a bit more than they did maybe even 5-10 years ago. So these are the big things that I thought warranted further exploration.
But how do they live within a society and get this information to be able to speak up when there is no, I know there's like QQ and there's WeChat and things of that nature, which is alternatives or alternatives to Twitter and Facebook. But, you know, you can't get Google because obviously Google won't extract certain information from their searches. I mean, how does that work there in China where, you know, they're trying to be on an open basis and even keel with the rest of the world, but there is blockage?
Yeah, I mean, the internet is heavily censored and it's becoming even more so, but there's all kinds of workarounds. I mean, it's not a perfect system by any means. I mean, the search engines block out certain search terms, but I mean, Chinese have ways around them. Like instead of saying the government directly, they might say ZF, which means junk food, Chinese word for government. All kinds of workarounds like this. If people want to jump over the Great Firewall, the censorship apparatus, there are plenty of ways of doing so with VPNs and proxies. As many censors as China employs, they just cannot keep up with all the conversations happening. So, I mean, there are plenty of ways to get information if you are determined to do so.
I mean, when I was in China, I just came back 2 weeks ago, and we had internet, and we had on our iPhones and computers, we installed VPNs. It was very easy just to log on, turn on your VPN, and boom, you just, you know, it appears you're in, you know, New Orleans or you're in, you know, Chattanooga or somewhere, or for that matter, wherever it is, and just getting all the information you need from Google, et cetera. But it's pretty interesting how China, on one hand, wants to be obviously communist rule. On the other hand, I think this is the big issue there, not good or bad, but just the overwhelming obvious, like, hello, they want to be also capitalistic. And is that kind of what the next generation is all about, that they realize what the opportunities are with capitalism and they're trying to break into that? Or is there something different going on?
Well, I think, I mean, China's been pretty capitalist for the last 20, 30 years. So I think that kind of mindset's been there for a long time. And I actually kind of see, I mean, because China was unrepentantly capitalist for such a long time, I think for a while there's been a pretty strong emphasis on making money and materialism. And that kind of replaced the socialist moral order. I mean, like striving for egalitarianism, putting the masses ahead of your own personal needs. And that really started to break down in the 80s and 90s. But I think we're actually starting to get past that with a lot of young people and starting to want, you know, more out of life, some kind of meaning. You see all kinds of young people doing volunteering, joining environmental groups, and doing all sorts of stuff that I think moves beyond the pure, unrestrained capitalist mentality.
Hmm. Chapter 8 of your book talks about young entrepreneurs. And a couple of things that are interesting is, you know, when you look at China and you look at where the wealth is concentrated today, and for the most part, it's government jobs, right? Because there's been a lot of, well, hanky-panky that went on with a lot of the governments and grafts that, you know, and payoffs and under-the-table deals and all that. But it was for a long time that in China, if you wanted to get along and you wanted to really do well, the, you know, your goal was, hey, I want to be in government. How has that changed?
Yeah, I wouldn't say like the most wealth is actually in government posts. A lot of it definitely is among the elites, but some of the fantastically wealthy people in China have very close government connections. I think that's very much still the case, that if you want to become tremendously wealthy, you have to have some kind of connection there. And I think that's only gotten worse over time. I mean, the wealth inequality in China continues to become worse and worse. So,
but that inequality deals with not so much like we have it here, which is it's corporate ownership and companies. It's really the distance you are from the government, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is similar to the U.S. and that a lot of it is accumulating around companies. I think how opaque China's system is, how restrained the media is for about reporting on certain people. Yeah, I mean, distance from the government definitely hurts you if you want to accumulate money. But I think there are a lot of similarities in that, like in the U.S., it's easy to keep getting wealthier if you're already wealthy. And in China, just the whole system is set up to make that even more exacerbated.
Mm, interesting. So what are the barriers to entry for young entrepreneurs these days in China?
There's still a lot of fear of risk of making a startup. I mean, there's a lot of cultural factors. Their parents largely want them to go into a stable line of work. I mean, they grew up in a time of great instability and time when just getting a meal on your plate was a hard thing. So a lot of parents still today, if their kid talks about doing a startup, they'll say that's really risky. You should get a job at a stable company and even better at a government run company. So that's one, the family pressure. And China's, I mean, the landscape for businesses is getting better, like the rule of law and having confidence that if you do everything to the letter of the law, you'll get by. I mean, it is getting better, but it's still not very good, especially when you can compare to developed Western countries. So there's a lot of fear that if I start a company, then somebody else is going to swipe my idea and use their better resources and their better government connections to push it forward. So these are some of the big things I think that scare people away from doing business in the first place, starting something new.
Well, so much of the, as we at least know from this side of the pond, is that there's so many copies and so many lookalikes and so many, you know, there's kind of on one hand copies or like or similar types of products that are I don't want to say stolen, but are at least you know, snagged from things outside of China that are rebuilt there. We always hear about this. And then there's the next thing, which I've noticed, is you have like copies of the copies. So for example, in China, there's popular phones. There's the iPhone, there's various Samsung, there's Huawei, there's Xiaomi, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm probably butchering all those pronunciations. But nonetheless, like I saw copies of things that were like copies of the Fitbit Mi band. And there's like copies of the copy. So like Xiaomi has done a lot of work at trying to replicate very popular devices at a very low cost. And it's interesting. So I would understand how there's a concern about, hey, if you have an idea, it's going to be ripped off, because it's part of it. Seems it's part of the culture.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's been a big problem for a long time. Like I said, the government's long realized what a hindrance that is to innovation and entrepreneurship, and they have tried to crack down on it. I think things are gradually getting better, but I mean, there's still a long, long way to go. And I think an even bigger barrier is just a general lack of trust in society of doing business with people and trusting that the courts are going to rule fairly if there's some kind of dispute. So you have all these legal, social, cultural issues kind of throwing up these barriers to young entrepreneurs.
Well, I went to I went down in Xi'an to the Terracotta Warriors. And one of the stories they tell you is that the farmer who found the Terracotta Warriors on his farm, you know, he was digging, he was doing whatever, and he found something, and he brought it to the government to say, hey, I think I found something here. The government basically confiscated his land and paid him a dollar.
Yeah.
That's kind of no wonder why they're concerned about the fair rulings of the court. Because if something can be confiscated that easily at that level. Now, whether or not you know, where the fairness is of that, and should this guy have been able to just, you know, do it on his own? I mean, but the other thing in China is my understanding is that no one owns land there. The government owns all the land, right?
Right. So if you find anything, it belongs to the government. Yeah.
So maybe it's not a good idea to get out there with the metal detector, you know?
Right. and dovetailing on that example, you used another example of that in the business sphere. A couple of years ago, taxi hailing apps started getting pretty popular in Chinese cities. And most taxi companies are government-owned, so immediately government sprang into action. Shenzhen banned these apps altogether. And then some cities made all these regulations that favored existing taxi companies, and then they had state-owned taxi apps that sprouted up and then pushed the people who'd started the whole thing, the private entrepreneurs, out of the sphere. So a lot of examples like that.
Well, obviously stands to reason why there's some fear of this. Let's talk about in Chapter 6, you talk about the youth unemployment situation there. Talk to me a little bit about what is the current status of the youth unemployment, some of the reasons for that, and possibly what is being done to change it.
So this is, I mean, China is kind of odd in that the more education you have, the worse your employment prospects are. So people with college degrees have the highest unemployment rate right now. And a lot of this traces back to 1999 after the Asian financial crisis hit. And at that time, Chinese leaders saw that education was one sphere that there was a lot of demand. A lot of people wanted to go to college, but they weren't allowing that many people to do so. So they just had this bright idea, well, hey, if we dramatically expand college enrollment, then people will spend money associated with education, we'll keep young people out of the workforce while this crisis is going on, and then hopefully we'll have a more skilled workforce down the line. So they basically, over the next 2 years, college enrollment doubled from 1 million to 2 million. Now it's over 7 million new students every year. And we're getting to the point now, for a while now, there's been a lot more college graduates than there are white-collar jobs to absorb them. And every year, just the numbers are kind of staggering. This year, there were 250,000 more college graduates than last year, and about 20 to 30% fewer jobs. So this is getting pretty dismal, and a lot of graduates have been going on for several years now without finding a job. Some rely on their parents. They go back home and just hope things will turn around. Some reluctantly get factory jobs. And this is a huge problem the government has recognized, and they're trying to find places to put all these people. But unfortunately, I mean, the jobs just aren't there. And just every year you have a new raft of graduates, and just compounds and compounds the problem. So there's really not a good solution in sight, unfortunately.
Well, would it be an exodus from China?
That would be some pretty serious numbers if that was going to happen. I mean, there's 7.5 million new graduates each year, so that would be a pretty massive exodus if that's gonna solve the problem. There is a lot of demand on the lower end of the on the blue collar scale. I mean, the A lot of factories complain that they can't find enough workers. A lot of factory owners complain, well, kids these days just aren't willing to do hard labor, aren't willing to work in factories, and they have high expectations, which, I mean, when you enroll all these kids in college, of course, you've built up their expectations and didn't have a place to put them, so they're not going to be very anxious to go back down to the factories where they were taught they could avoid by getting an education.
Right.
So that's one thing the government's trying to do, is increase young people to get a more vocational or technical education instead of like a four-year liberal arts degree. I think that is starting to take hold among some people. They're starting to see the market realities and having a more realistic approach, but it still has a long ways to catch on in the numbers that it needs to.
So what is the view of this grouping, this millennials, of the government structure they're living under and democracy? I mean, do they have a, you know, any kind of viewing on, you know, wow, democracy is great, democracy is terrible, you know, we live inside of this, you know, communist rule and regime? What is the overall impression of, and their opinion of the concept of democracy?
Well, I think an interesting thing about the young generation is how diverse opinions are. I mean, you can ask 10 young people this question and you'll get 10 different answers. So yes, some very enthusiastically admire American-style democracy. Some are ardent defenders of the communist system in China the way it is. But the overwhelming answers I got when I asked young people this question, and I tried to ask just about everybody that I could about this, the overwhelming answer was, yeah, American-style democracy is great, but I don't think China can handle it. I don't think it's ready for it. Maybe in 30, 50 years we can develop to something like that. But if we were to open up free elections for all of China today, then it would be chaos. And this is a message that the government has pretty much emphasized. I mean, like the Arab Spring a couple of years ago, the government really emphasized through media the chaos that's broken out there under the democracy that emerged afterwards, the very messy and chaotic democracy. And I think this is a message that's sold pretty well to most people in China that, yeah, the Communist Party, the system is not great. It's maybe the worst system, except for any alternative that there might be. So a twist on the old Winston Churchill saying on democracy, the Communist Party is the worst form of government, except for any other alternative that there could be.
Right.
And I mean, the Communist Party has done a good job at eliminating any potential rival that could rise up and present an alternative to its rule. But I think that this is a pretty well sold message, and that young people look back at the last 20, 30 years and see how fast China's grown economically under this system. They say, well, hey, it's been stable so far, so why shake the boat?
Who knows if it's in spite of the growth is in spite of themselves, just from the growing, you know, structure of where a lot of this started, where a lot of offshoring of jobs from other places around the world, many of them democratic, to China, and then, you know, the whole growth factor from there, and then the continued expansion of their population, and then of course the continued expansion of the young people in their population. You know, who knows? Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's still a young country overall. But the one thing that has been going on in terms of the changes, or I shouldn't maybe say the change, but the continuation of a situation which is a very significant gender imbalance. You talk about this in chapter 9. Tell me a little bit about that.
So China has a long preference for boys stretching back centuries. But when the one-child policy hit, you can only have one kid, then that really made people realize, well, if we're going to have one kid, we better make sure it's a boy. And then when ultrasound started becoming affordable and sex-selective abortion started happening, it really exacerbated this. So in the 90s, this really started getting bad. And right now, there are about 20 million excess males between age 20 and 49. So marriage age men in the Chinese population because of this, and that's expected to keep growing for the foreseeable future. I mean, the gender imbalance at birth peaked, they said, around 2008, but then you're going to have the delayed effects. So men entering the marriage market, or when this really becomes more volatile, and they're predicting that this could peak somewhere between 40 and 50 million excess marriage age men in the Chinese population. And I mean, this is having all sorts of dramatic effects. There have been studies that have found a correlation in the increase in the crime rates to the gender imbalance. There was one study that found every 1% increase in the gender imbalance creates a 3.7% increase in the crime rate. This is pushing up savings rates because men, to be more desirable on the marriage market, feel like they need to save a lot of money, have a house before a woman will consider them. So you see men just saving as much as they possibly can to buy a house, which has astronomical cost in China right now. So you have all these weird kind of socioeconomic effects sprouting from this gender imbalance.
Well, it seems to me that the answer to this is to come up with a killer dating app.
Well, right? That's one industry that has grown quite remarkably is dating websites. A lot of dating websites kind of promote this idea.
Well, especially because some of the old ways, if you know about this, you go to some of the public parks in China, and in these public parks, there's a variety of areas. They have the crazy exercise that goes on, the dancing that goes on, and they have a lot of them have sections called the matchmaking section, I believe it's called, where they have people, mothers and fathers, and they put advertisements up for their kid to get married. So they'll have a pole, and on top of the pole is like a bunch of papers. Then maybe their qualifications, what they've done, their education, the pictures, things of that nature. And then other parents are walking up and down looking at this saying, oh, yeah, that would be great for my daughter and doing a matchmaking. I mean, that seems to be a very inefficient way of trying to get this situation solved.
And actually, the kids usually hate it when they find out that their parents are doing that.
Oh, I can imagine. It's embarrassing.
The interesting thing about that is in the cities, that's really popular. But it's actually the opposite in the cities. Of most of the parents there are of young women trying to set up their daughters, because you have this kind of reverse phenomenon where, as you see in countries around the world, as the economy develops, more women enter the economy and they put off marriage later and later. So parents have this idea that, well, if their daughter reaches 30, they're going to be what's known in China as a leftover woman. They'll be totally unmarriable. So this is, in fact, a case. Women are marrying later and, in more cases, not marrying at all, which is making this excess of males at the bottom of the socioeconomic food chain even more exacerbated. And the government's actually kind of promoted this as well, encouraging women to get married earlier. They put out these campaigns talking about leftover women, and you can kind of see this concern that if we have too many women that don't get married, then you're going to have even more leftover men that are going to be causing these social trouble.
Yeah, what do we call them? Yeah. Spinsters and misers.
Right.
Yeah, they're leftovers. It's like kind of a doggy bag. One of the things about China that I noticed is that they're very into status. So. For example, I was talking to some people, and we talked about people when they start businesses. One of the first things they do is they go out and they get a car, because if you have a new car, people think that you're very successful. Or, you know, the difference in phone. You know, here in the United States, it's more of a choice. What phone do I want? I don't know. I want the Android. I want this. I want that. I mean, very rarely do you see somebody with a flip phone, but I don't know. Personally, I don't like look at you and go, oh, what kind of phone does he have? And let's see how successful he is.
Right.
But there it's a much more status-driven, materialistic society, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. Again, though, I think this is something that's gradually changing. I think people born in the 1980s in China are especially notorious for being very materialistic because, I mean, when society is developing and some people are rich and some people aren't, I mean, symbols of status are a much bigger deal than, like, in the U.S. where, I mean, most people are somewhat comfortable. For a while it used to be the thing that is the most expensive or the thing that looks the most expensive is what's going to sell. There's like a joke in China that if you want to come in and sell something, paint it gold and quadruple the price and the Chinese will go crazy for it. But I think we're gradually starting to get away from that. I mean, iPhones, for example, used to be the big symbol of status, but now the market's becoming a little bit more fragmented. People looking for different kinds of phones. And I think people born in the 90s are becoming much more individualistic, and status is still a big thing, but it's not necessarily like there's one product that confers status. I think people are branching out into more individualized pursuits. So if they want to show status, they might do it in a way that shows whatever kind of identity they want to express. So maybe they'll buy a high-end Nike running watch. because they want to show that they're an athlete, but also a well-off athlete.
But that's the interesting thing. You know, in China, it is, you mentioned something about they're looking to get more individualistic. There's a major herd mentality there, from what I can see, at least from what I saw. Sort of like everybody's doing what everybody's doing.
Yeah, that's definitely true, too, when you look at Chinese society as a whole. But again, I think that's more true of older generations. And the younger you get, I think the more we're sort of getting away from that. It's becoming okay to be an individual. I mean, I think overall that's still true. If you're the nail that sticks out, you're going to be hammered down. That's the fear that people have.
Right.
But I think, yeah, gradually the younger you get, the more you have people who've grown up on the internet and have seen very different points of view, very different lifestyles that they could be a part of, and kind of realizing, hey, it's okay if I don't exactly match the status quo. But again, yeah, you're very correct in that overall, when you look at the entire population, still a herd mentality on a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, this is Eric Fish, again, author of China's Millennials, The Want Generation. You can pick up the book at all sorts of good places. And I want to thank you for joining us and giving us a lot of this information, but lots more in the book. We just scratched the surface on some of this very fascinating information about the transformation of what's happening with this generation in China and future generations in China. So thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. I put the actual link to grab his book over on Amazon on the show notes for this episode of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So go over there and grab it. You'll see a link right there. I think you'll find it interesting reading. And I think it's something that is really important for all of us to understand more about, because China is growing in population, growing in power, growing in economic importance. And all those things are extremely important when it comes to our future and your future and my future and our kids' futures. So it's something that we really need to understand a little bit more about, and something that I think has been, you know, over there concept. Yeah, it's over there. I don't see it. It's kind of happening there, and it affects me a little bit, but it is a big effect. There could be significant reverberations when we see something happen there and how it affects us here. So, you know, the car industry, the technology, software industry, defense, etc., hacking, you know, all these things are really going to affect you somehow, maybe not directly, but something we need to be aware of. I mentioned we were going to talk about China a little bit in terms of their markets, and I thought that it would be a good time to kind of bring up the fact that things are a big mess over there. We saw that on Monday of last week, there was an 8% drop in the Shanghai index. We saw a follow-up of about a 2% after a 5% intraday drop on that market. Popped up about 1% the next day, a couple percent, then it dropped down again a couple percent. What's happening? People are scared over there. That's what's happening. The government has been involved, I don't mean just on the sidelines, actively involved in buying shares, coercing people and brokerage firms to buy shares, and doing an all-out media blitz on why it is the way to wealth when it comes to your future and the benefits of buying stocks in order to do so. And they've lost control of their markets. The problem is that that kind of plunge, a 40% plunge from July 12th to where we are today, is significant as hell to scare the crap out of anybody. And when you're seeing that 30% of their stocks are still halted for trading, whereas at one point there was close to, I think, about 90, 95% of all the stocks on the Shanghai index was halted for trading. That's not good. They've made every misstep possible, including the fact that they tried to put about $19 or $20 billion into the markets and to shore it up, and things failed from there. The fact is that they made things move up way too quickly on very little supportive information in terms of earnings growth, in terms of a weakening economy. You know, they did this all at the wrong time, and therefore it created an incredible amount of groundswell. And where most of the investors in this market are retail, not institutions, you know, you don't have people that will hold on to things for a long time and buy things on anything other than momentum, speculation. You're starting to hear stories about people who invested $150,000, margined it up to $1 million, and now they are not only out of money, but they owe money back on margin. That's a bad situation. When that type of story spreads around China, where a lot of them have a herd mentality, as we just talked about with Eric Fish, our guest, The fact is that you start to realize that maybe there's a bigger problem right here. And as the whole hope was to bring up the wealth effect very quickly for China, and now you have so many people ruined, even though the markets are still up 50% for the year, I get that. But this 40% drop where you saw the massive amount of retail investors opening up accounts in May, right at the top of the market, and getting obliterated, that's going to cause a big problem. And it's also going to call into question the standing of China's markets in the various indices that are around the world, and to question whether or not institutions will be actually able to confidently and with a confidence in their fiduciary capacity to their clients invest in those markets. So I think those are extremely important things that you need to look at. Well, when I looked a little further into some of the things after this whole China thing, and we've been investing in and out of yin and yang. Look at those symbols. Those are three times multipliers of the Hang Seng Index, which does somewhat follow along with China. Not the same as directly investing in some of the other ones, the DB Harvest, China A, or et cetera. Those are a bit thinner traded, and that's not really – I want something that has some more action and hedging capability for our portfolios. That's over on the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. We've actually had, I think three or four different turns in the last 2 or 3 weeks. Very successful. The first time we were up 27%, then I think 15%, then another 20% on those positions. And they're pretty, you need to have these, like, let's say, maximum of, 1.5, 2 weeks max, maybe 1 week really. These are, short-term trading opportunities where you can actually go short or long the Hang Seng Index. And even though the Hang Seng is a much better structured market and where it has less of direct retail investors comparatively to compared to the Shanghai index, the fact is that there is some spillover effect on the Hang Seng index and China as a in its totality. So you can play that really nicely in terms of a quasi China play. But there are other ones also out there that you can look at. Moving along very quickly to the Fed, I think I've decided the Fed has no clue as what's going on. Their economic forecasts are off. Their outlook is suspect at best. And I think they are now in a position that they just believe that they need to raise rates because they are going to lose face if they don't do so. The truth of the matter is that if you look at the economy from just a position of, okay, where are we now? Where is the trend? And where are rates now? Not what the level of rates are, but where are rates now? It doesn't seem to be the time to be increasing interest rates from what I can see. But the Fed will probably use this opportunity at least to get in a quick interest rate hike, thinking that it's already priced into markets, and then hold off for a lot, a significant period of time. So consider that when the next couple of meetings come, I think there'll be a lot of disappointment, a lot of confusion, if in fact they don't raise rates. Meanwhile, you did see the dollar come off a bit, still at a pretty high level compared to where it was. Oil at 47 and change, really taking a absolute shellacking this month, along with copper. Have you seen copper? That looks ugly. Along with gold, silver, platinum, zinc, nickel. Just go down the list of all the commodities have been just absolutely smashed. Two-part reason why, obviously, is because, as we mentioned, the dollar, also China slowdown. The oil one is a real, real concern. One of the things you're not seeing is gas prices go down, and that has a lot to do with the whole crack spreads and refining and a good amount of other items that are kind of embedded in the markets. We will probably see them come down if, in fact, there is any further drop in the price of oil, but it seems to be a real concern that there is not a more significant move in oil prices right now. So when it comes to stocks, we are definitely seeing a hit or miss earnings season. We're seeing things like Apple, okay. You're seeing that, Google, great. We're seeing that Netflix, wow, that's awesome. Seeing that Facebook was slowing down. Twitter was a disaster. LinkedIn drove up to begin with and then came down about 10% right after when the realization of what their earnings really meant and really were comprised of meant. But this is, when you look at the bigger picture, kind of back away for a second, and you see that there are some companies that are doing so well in some sectors, healthcare, consumer discretionary staples, And then you look at it, commodities and the oil sector, ugh, just horrible. This is where that confusion comes in, and the consolidation pattern that's been playing out really comes into, because you mix that all up and you kind of get, you know, much more of a weighted to one end versus the other. And the question is, can all of this sustain if some of these sectors are doing so poorly? Can the healthcare continue doing really well with all this? Now, there's a bill passed, for example, over the weekend, and there was I think it was $500 or $600 million that was dedicated for Hep C, and that's going to be good probably for AbbVie and Gilead, two stocks that we actually own. This whole Hep C movement that's been going on, which is a cure for the hepatitis C situation, you know, has come about about a year and a half ago, but a total eradication of hepatitis C, it seems, right now. And Gilead is the leader in that area, GILD. And you also have AbbVie, ABBV is the symbol. And these two stocks are leading the pack when it comes to this. And you may see another upward move on Monday due to the fact that there was this highway bill passed. And somehow embedded in this highway bill was $600 million worth of hepatitis C funding, or at least money to be used to buy hepatitis C drugs, which go for about $80,000 to $90,000 per full dose, which is absurd, by the way. But okay, that's what it is, and all this money now is available to help. So that would be, let's see, how many people is that? That's not that many people, right? 90,000 is 100,000. So it's only five or six different. That's only like six. Well, that doesn't seem like a lot of money now that I think about it. 60, 70, maybe. Maybe it's reasonable. But I guess you're going to get a bunch of people that will be very happy about this, and there's more funding now. I guess it is a pretty good amount of money. I guess when you kind of cut it down to the fact that an extra $500 or $600 million to the bottom line or to the sales is pretty good for the quarter in the big picture, especially for AbbVie. But Gilead's been the leader in this area. So anyway, when we look at the aging demographics of the United States and the big problems with diabetes around the world and the potential for solutions and cures, or at least enhancements to drugs that can help with life-sustaining opportunities, hey, that looks like a good sector. It looks really terrible when you look at oil and the oil prices and commodities and global slowdown, etc. So I think that's what's playing out in the markets right now. Technology is just all over the place. You'll see some slowdown probably in technology if, in fact, the world continues to slow. But if we stay at this kind of slogging movement as we are in right now with enhancements, that could be good. The big question is whether or not Facebook, Twitter, and some of the other social media will maintain their ability to garner significant advertising revenue. I've always been a real suspect of whether or not Twitter can have an advertising platform that makes any sense. And one of the big things is that we're seeing that their monthly active users are slowing down considerably. And as such, is a big concern about the opportunity for them to grow and grow their advertising revenue over time, as advertisers look at the fact that part of the core membership is in countries where they really probably can't advertise any of their products to make a good amount of money from, and that there is very limited growth. There's alternative products right now around the world, whether it's in China, QQ, in Latin America, or WeChat, or you know, even in the United States with Instagram or with Snapchat, for example. These are alternatives that are taking a big piece of Twitter's turf. And who knows if Facebook itself will actually come out with something like Twitter. Will Twitter be bought? I don't know. It seems like you can build a lot of this, and if you have the kind of users that Facebook has, I don't know why they'd want to buy the Twitter users. There's probably a lot of overlap there. Anyway, like I mentioned, if you want to find more information, of course, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You could send me an email at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, one word. And, of course, listen to DH Unplugged and this week's episode of Wall Street Unplugged with Frank Curzio. Until next week, where we have our guest Jim Rogers coming aboard. I want to thank you so much and wish you a very happy August. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Discipline Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.